Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. A roof ripped off a baseball stadium, a crane that crashed into the offices of a newspaper, the shelter over a petrol station lying on its side in a street full of water. Just some of the damage caused by Hurricane Milton as it pummeled the US state of Florida overnight. The storm has now moved into the Atlantic, but it is still producing dangerously strong winds and huge amounts of rain over land. And the impact of those, as well as a number of tornadoes, is only now becoming apparent. Several people are reported to have been killed. Millions are without power. Many others are without running water. Milton made landfall last night close to Sarasota, south of the city of Tampa, packing winds of over 200 kilometres an hour. Melanie Bevan is chief of police in Bradenton to the south of Tampa. This is what she told us during the night.
The first few hours we were getting significant winds, but this second half, boy, it is punching us hard. And we're getting 110 mile gust. We see roofs flying, trees flying around. It's pretty ugly out there. If people chose poorly and they stayed in their homes that were ill-equipped to handle storm surge and wind, what we'll probably be finding in the morning are bodies. We saw somebody riding their bike down the road. We still see a car from time to time. Those conditions are incredibly, incredibly unsafe. And I've just got to assume that those are one of the 10% of the dumbest people in the world.
Within the past hour, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis has been speaking.
Around 8:30 last night, Hurricane Milton made landfall near Siesta Key in Sarasota County. It moved quickly across central Florida overnight, producing significant flooding and damaging winds near its path. The storm did bring much destruction and damage. Tornadoes ravaged parts of the east coast of the state. Flooding occurred on the west and east coast, and strong winds lashed the state, especially in Pinellas, Hillsborough, Manatee, and Sarasota.
Well, the BBC's Gordon Carrera is in Tampa, now heading south towards some of the worst hit areas. The line was a bit choppy when I spoke to him a short time ago, but how are things looking?
Well, the sun came up over Tampa and you could see trees blocking some of the roads, debris left over from Hurricane Helene 2 weeks ago, particularly on one part, Davis Island, which we've been around. So certainly a lot of damage and the power in a lot of places. So traffic lights not working. Fairly minimal traffic. People are taking the advice to stay at home and wait and let the emergency services focus on recovery and rescue at this point. So I think it is still in the phase of people trying to understand the scale of the damage and where it's worst.
What happened to the storm surge that was predicted or at least feared in the hours before the hurricane hit?
That was the big worry, particularly in the Tampa Bay area, which is normally home, that wider area to about 3 million people, that a 15-foot high potential storm surge could have done really terrible damage. Now, that didn't hit at that level. I think partly because Milton ended up making landfall slightly further south, slightly earlier than people expected. So I think Tampa was spared the worst that people feared. So there is damage, but not that kind of wide-scale flooding through the city, which could have been devastating. That didn't happen. So I think the question will be whether further south and inland, whether there is more damage there. So Tampa, I think, will feel some sense of relief today.
What is the advice being given to residents at the moment then? Are people just being told to stay at home for the next few hours?
Yes, I mean, about half of the city of Tampa, so about 200,000 people, actually left the city and about the other half who weren't in mandatory evacuation zones were down, and people are being told to stay where they are, effectively, because they don't want people to get in the way of emergency services who are moving around trying to do rescue and recovery. And so on the whole, the roads, everything else is still pretty quiet as people wake up, assess what the damage is, and work out when and how they move. Also down, there is a limit to where people can and want to go, I think, at the moment.
I mean, you've been there for a few days. This part of Florida really has suffered a double whammy. What, two hurricanes in less than 2 weeks?
That's right. And I think that was always one of the concerns, is that the Helene 2 weeks ago did do significant damage and killed 200 people, with more still missing, and left debris everywhere. That debris still hadn't been cleared up when Milton was arriving. That gives you some idea of the sense of one after the other that's hit the communities here. And I think that's why it's felt particularly worrisome for people in this region.
The BBC's Gordon Carrera. Well, let's hear from Sarasota County, where the hurricane made landfall. Sandra Tapfumane is the emergency management chief there. Thanks so much for giving us your time on News Hour today. What is the situation where you are?
Oh, well, good morning. Thanks for having us on. So we've just had just a few hours of daylight here, and we've sent crews out actually well before daylight to start clearing roads. Also first responders out trying to get to some of the calls that came in while the storm passed, the 911 calls, emergency calls. We're now getting out to check on people. So right now we're trying to assess what the storm surge damages and wind damages are for the county. We know that we got about 7 to 8 feet of storm surge, which for us is more than we got from Hurricane Helene just 2 weeks ago. So it has been a very busy hurricane season down here for Southwest Florida.
So is it your initial assessment that there will be extensive damage in your part of Florida?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just alone, Hurricane Helene 2 weeks ago with 5 feet of storm surge caused $1 billion of residential damage to structures for residents. And we had just started doing the business assessment for damages when we had to hunker down and get prepared for this next Hurricane Milton. So we're anticipating the number to climb steadily. Some of the homes that were damaged for this hurricane were damaged for the previous one. So we're getting some information to how to assess those damages and how do you add on damage to something that's already damaged, right? But we're working on that. But we think, between now, we have some additional wind damage that was not prevalent with the previous hurricane. So a lot of assessments being done today so that we can really see the full extent of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, and just thinking about the immediate term, I mean, what's the situation with power and running water in Sarasota?
Yeah, so water is not too bad. We do have some interruptions to some water. There was water that was cut off purposefully to the barrier islands in order to create a barrier, if you will, for storm surge to come in and break some of those lines. So we're getting those restored as quickly as possible. But really, the power outage is the bigger story. So about two-thirds of the county out of power right now, about 220,000 people. So we are working on that quickly with our power company to try to get things restored as quickly as possible.
Have you had any reports of deaths in your county or injuries?
No. So we have not. There was, some minor injuries yesterday with people preparing for the storm, but nothing significant. But we will be keeping a watchful eye on that. We do know that there was hundreds of people that are stayed out on Longboat Key. We cannot access that key right now, that island, because the bridge over to get to there is damaged. So we need to get out to check on those individuals that stayed. And we know that there was a number of people that did choose to stay in other areas. So we just need to do, we're doing some search and rescue operations right now just to check on those that we know stayed put. But overall, I think that we're going to be in hopefully good shape, but you never know. That's why we're doing that thorough analysis.
Yeah. And just briefly, I mean, this is going to take Sarasota months to recover from, I mean, Milton and Helene, isn't it?
It is. And actually, we didn't mention the third hurricane that we had, Hurricane Debbie, that came in August. So we've had three hurricanes in 2 months. And that one was a rainmaker. So we had intense flooding, 4 to 5 feet of rain in people's homes for that one as well. So, yes, it is. This has been a very long hurricane season, and we will be recovering for months. Our one prayer is that we don't get faced with another one before the end of the season at the end of November.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll let you get on with your work. That was Sandra Tapfupane, Emergency Management Chief in Sarasota County. Well, let's head north of Sarasota and north of Tampa to Cedar Key, an island off the coast. It is home to about 700 people and got hit badly by Hurricane Helene 2 weeks ago. We can speak to Mike Bobbitt, who we spoke to yesterday on NewsHour. Mike lives on Cedar Key. Thanks for being with us again on NewsHour. Do you feel that you dodged a bullet last night?
Thanks for having me. Absolutely, in every sense of the word. It was a long, stressful night of waiting for a sword to drop that never did. As you mentioned, we were absolutely devastated during Hurricane Helene with nearly 12 feet of storm surge. Most of our commercial buildings are in ruin, more than half of our homes. And we had a solid 9 days of cleanup where we had debris piled multiple stories high all over the island. And the fear was that the hurricane force winds would create projectile missiles all over town and undo all of our work. But we, throughout the night, it just never came. And no storm surge at all. In fact, we had negative storm surge because we were north of the storm. We got the clean side of the hurricane. 3 miles of water in the Wakasasa Bay washed out. You could walk 3 miles into the bay before you found any water. We are feeling just enormously blessed this morning.
It is just relative, though, as you say, that the cleanup from Helene can now continue, I guess.
Sure, but we have literally months ahead of us. I've never been so pleased to see giant piles of debris all over my town because they're right where we left them. And already we're out. We've got our trucks out and our boots and our work gloves, and the whole town is out working to just push the work forward. I think there could not have been a better outcome from what we were facing 24 hours ago.
I mean, as we were hearing there from Sarasota, 3 hurricanes in short succession. I mean, are some people wondering whether it's just becoming too dangerous as these storms become more powerful?
I think so. I think maybe some of the northerners that moved to Florida who thought they knew what they were getting into have maybe decided that this isn't for them. But not me. I'll live on this island for the rest of my life if I have to live in a tent under the bridge. The natural splendor of this area, being able to have a working waterfront where blue-collar people can make a living from the Gulf of Mexico. We're primarily clam farmers and oystermen and commercial fishermen here. We really are a village lost in time, and I think it's a place worth protecting. And I've always described the Gulf as the great provider. It provides our jobs, our income. But sometimes it's an angry God and it comes to exact a price. And we've paid that price now. This was our 4th major hurricane in 13 and a half months. But prior to that, we had been multiple decades without any significant damage from a hurricane. So if you smooth those statistics out, it's not so bad.
Mike, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Mike Bobbitt speaking to us from Cedar Key, an island off the west coast of Florida. We'll be returning to this story later in the program. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. A further 65 women have contacted the BBC with allegations against the businessman and former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed, going back as far as the 1970s. Their accounts include accusations of rape, sexual assault and sexual harassment, and were sent to the BBC in the 3 weeks since the broadcast of the BBC documentary Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Al-Fayed died last year. Helena Wilkinson has this report, and there are details in her piece you may find distressing.
Dubai in the 1970s, different from today. A small port town, rapidly growing. Ready to make money from its expansion was a businessman in his 40s, Mohammed Al-Fayed.
Oil money is transforming the sands of Arabia, so even the tiniest sheikhdoms spend their newfound wealth on huge projects designed to keep them in business long after the wells run dry.
He seemed to have more hands than a normal human being somehow. They would seem to be all over him. He was sort of doing this at me and lurching at me with his hands.
Sheena was 25 at the time and moved from Britain with her construction worker husband to Dubai, where she became a bank clerk. An appointment in the bank led to a job offer from Mohammed Al-Fayed, but also at a meeting, something much worse.
And then he sort of lurched and both of his hands came down over my shoulders to the front. And then one hand came down and went on my leg. I just was stunned, really. That's the best word I can think of. I was stunned. And eventually he moved and told me that I would regret it. His parting shot was, you will regret it.
Sheena, who's waived her right to anonymity, says for months Al-Fayed would follow her and continue his threats. Sometimes he would grope her again.
And in the end, I realised that stalking was something that describes beautifully what he was doing to me. That is the perfect word.
Sheena's allegation is the earliest against Al-Fayed that the BBC is aware of.
So that's a long time before the Harrods and the Ritz events were going on. So I thought people seem to be concentrating on these two as being his bad times. No, he did it from 1977, in which case he obviously did it from 1977 forever in his life after that.
8 years later, and Al-Fayed is back in the UK and in the process of taking over Harrods. At his Grade 1 listed 17th century mansion in Surrey, he is hiring more staff, including this woman who thought she was becoming the family's nanny.
He started to stroke my thigh under my skirt.
Margot, which isn't her real name, was 19. Her interview is portrayed here by an actor.
One morning before 5 a.m, I was awoken by my bedroom door opening and Al-Fayed came in, shutting the door behind him. He sat down on my bed, deliberately squashing me up against the wall. Then he got under the sheets with me. His hands were everywhere. He raped me.
Margot says she was kept prisoner by Al-Fayed for several days at the house and was repeatedly sexually assaulted. Like other women the BBC has spoken to, Margot believes she was offered the job under false pretences.
The job just didn't exist. He didn't need a nanny. He didn't want a nanny. Looking back, I believe I was recruited purely as a potential sex partner or plaything for Al-Fayed.
As the number of allegations against Al-Fayed increases, it's clear his apparent offending was not confined to his time at his best-known business, Harrods. They suggest he used a broader range of abuse tactics on an astonishing scale.
Helena Wilkinson reporting, and in response to our inquiries, Harrods have said since the airing of the documentary so far there are more than 200 individuals now in the process to settle claims directly with the business. This year's Nobel Prize for Literature has been won by the South Korean writer Han Kang. She's the author of books such as Human Axe, which explores the aftermath of the Gwangju massacre when the South Korean army crushed a popular uprising. That was back in 1980. She also wrote The White Book, and the latest of her works to be translated into English is Greek Lessons. However, it was The Vegetarian that brought her to the attention of a huge number of readers in the West. An intense and darkly erotic novel, it was an international bestseller and a winner of the International Man Booker Prize in 2016, when she spoke to NewsHour's Razia Iqbal.
Whenever I write novels, I feel I have to deal with my fundamental theme, which is what means being human. So because of that difficult question, this novel has become so dark and fierce, and I had to handle these difficulties Younghye, the protagonist, had to go through.
Han Kang there. Well, Anton Herr is a novelist and translator from South Korea, and he joins me now. Welcome to NewsHour. First of all, your reaction to her winning the Nobel Prize.
Oh, I haven't stopped crying in the past hour.
Really?
Yes, it is. It is incredible news, because it is news that we've, as a nation, have been waiting for years and years and years. And to have it happen to Han Kang is just perfect. It's the cherry on the cake.
What makes her so special as a writer, in your opinion?
the fact that she is a woman writer, I know it's not fashionable to say so, but it is a very important point in a country where there is so much misogyny and discrimination against women, that a woman writer who was not necessarily the front runner for prizes and for funding in her home country suddenly becomes the Booker Prize winner in 2016 and then now is the Nobel Prize winner. The fact that she wrote about two key traumatic events in Korean history. First, it was the Gwangju democracy movement of 1980. And then there was, then she has more recently written about the April 3rd massacre of, in Jeju Island, which some people say is the precursor to the Korean War. And it's just so wonderful that that Korea has produced a Nobel Prize winner in literature, and B, that it is this particular author and not some other author who is more problematic, and we won't get into that.
Right, okay. The role of women and the position of women in South Korea, I mean, is it right to say that that is a sort of key theme in the Vegetarian?
Very much so. But Han Kang, while she definitely does write about women and from a woman's perspective, obviously, she also writes about the disenfranchised across society. And as she just said in her comment that you played just now, her preoccupation is what makes us human, what is humanity, and how do we lose our humanity and how do we regain it? Is there redemption? And yeah, her topic is universal, it's humanist, and I think that's what makes her the perfect international author and really the perfect Korean author to win the Nobel Prize.
But not for the faint-hearted. I mean, these aren't easy novels, are they?
They are not. So when this prize was, when the Nobel Prize was being announced, I was actually in a meeting for the International Booker Prize 2025 because I'm in the jury. And Max Porter, who is the publisher of The Vegetarian in the UK, he's also in the jury. And so we were both like, as you can imagine, our reaction was very like, it interrupted the meeting.
Anton, I'm really sorry to interrupt you. We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, I'm afraid. That was Anton Herr, novelist and translator from South Korea. You're listening to NewsHour.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Stay with us. And you're listening to NewsHour. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in London this morning as part of a whistle-stop tour of European capitals, trying to shore up political and military support for his country's war effort against Russia. He met the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and the new Secretary-General of NATO, Mark Rutte. Mr. Rutte, a former Dutch premier, has given his first broadcast interview in the new role to the BBC. And my colleague Anita McVeigh asked him how he would change things to shift the war in Ukraine's favour.
It's crucial for Ukraine to prevail, and we have to avoid that Putin would get his way with and in Ukraine, because it's not only a problem for Ukraine, it is also a threat to all of us here in the UK, all over NATO, including Canada and the US, if Russia would be successful in Ukraine. It would be a security threat to all of us. So we have to massively continue what we are doing first, and that is to put military aid into Ukraine to make sure that we have enough training ready for the soldiers, the brave soldiers from Ukraine, and the brave people who are working there to counter the Russian onslaught.
But would you support Ukraine being given access to longer-range missiles to be able to fire those deeper into Russia? Militarily, we've heard from former senior commanders in Europe saying that Ukraine's allies need to be firmer, that dither and delay, as one of them put it, is not in Ukraine's interest. So would you personally support the use by Ukraine of longer range missiles to fire deeper into Russia?
Let me be very specific. First of all, Ukraine is allowed legally to strike targets in Russia when these targets pose a threat to Ukraine. So legally, this is possible. My second element of my answer will be that it is not one weapon system which will change the outcome of this conflict.
On the subject of membership, we saw recently the Slovak Prime Minister saying that as long as he's in power, he will block Ukrainian membership. What are you going to do to try to build consensus on that?
Well, clearly what we decided in Washington unanimously is that there is an irreversible path towards membership of NATO for Ukraine. And then, of course, the question is how to take this to the next steps and the next stage of this. And it really has to be done step by step. And that's something, of course, amongst allies we will discuss over the coming month, including up to the summit in The Hague and beyond, because this is a very sensitive issue. This is an important issue. But I said last week in Kiev, when I visited Volodymyr Zelensky and his team, is that one thing has to be absolutely clear, that Russia does not have a vote on this and that Russia does not have a veto on this. Every country in the area of NATO can apply for membership, and that is a sovereign decision for that individual country.
And that was Mark Rutte, the new Secretary General of NATO, talking there to the BBC's Anita McVeigh. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return to our top story now and Hurricane Milton, which is now heading out into the Atlantic Ocean, leaving behind a trail of destruction across central Florida and the likelihood of further flooding in the coming days. There is some relatively good news. The storm was not as fierce as feared when it made landfall, but 3 million people are without power. There have been a number of deaths reported. 70,000 people are still living in shelters. 18 inches of rain, that's well over 30 centimetres, fell in St. Petersburg and in Tampa. Jane Custer is the mayor of Tampa.
We didn't see that predicted storm surge, so that saved a lot. That was what we were really worried about, was the storm surge. And so fortunately, we didn't see the peak of it, but it's not over. At 7 o'clock this morning, when high tide comes in, rivers are going to flood all over Hillsborough County, not just in the city of Tampa.
Rolling news coverage has been the order of the day and night, with correspondents and anchors braving and sometimes getting in the way of the elements. This was CNN's Anderson Cooper at the water's edge.
The water now is really starting to pour over. If you look at the ground, whoa! Okay, that wasn't good. We'll probably go inside shortly.
Well, for many people in Florida, it has, of course, been an anxiety-ridden night. And with the new day comes a reckoning of the damage caused. Connor Ferrin's home in Fort Myers was hit by one of the many tornadoes that touched down. It tore his roof off.
Got really bad. Kept getting cold. Tornado warning. Then, like this, all this, this happened like instantaneously. Like these windows blew out. I was about probably right here. I grabbed the two dogs and like run under my bed. Probably 1 minute total. Probably less.
Well, in the past hour or so, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis has been speaking, and he gave this warning for people driving through flooded areas.
Please drive with caution and treat each light as you would a four-way stop. And also remember, if you're going to use a chainsaw, be very careful with that. We have mishaps on that after every storm. We're going to continue to support all remaining rescue missions that are underway and that may be needed in the near future. We'll also continue to assess the damage that was done from the storm. We also anticipate that because of the amount of water, you know, you may see flooding happen not just now, but in the subsequent days. But I think everybody responded very quickly. I'm proud of everybody's hard work. We got more work to do, but we will absolutely get through this.
the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. Well, with me in the NewsHour studio, the BBC's lead weather presenter, Elizabeth Rossini. Thanks for coming up. The storm surge was less than feared. Why was that?
Hi, James. The storm surge was originally forecast to be 15 at around the Tampa Bay region. In actual fact, there was a negative storm surge around Tampa Bay, and that's because instead of onshore winds, we actually saw offshore winds. So it was as if the bay drained. And that's what eyewitnesses are saying. But there was a storm surge further south, and this affected parts of Fort Myers, Sarasota. It's unconfirmed reports from the Weather Channel actually are saying that there was an 8-foot storm surge around Sarasota, and there was a storm surge further south as well, and there could still be a storm surge across some parts of the East Coast as well. Of course, a storm surge is when you get very brisk onshore winds, very strong onshore winds, in fact, and it's often the most dangerous part of a hurricane because the strong winds will blow this wall of water that will then move onshore as the sea depth becomes shallower, and you just get this wall of water, piles of water. And we saw it with Hurricane Helene. So it was, it's a real danger, but it's good news that Tampa, for example, didn't see that massive storm surge that was in the forecast for a while.
Talking about large volumes of water, nevertheless, a huge amount of rain fell, didn't it? I mean, we're talking historic amounts of rain in some places.
Yes, so 18 inches of rainfall for Tampa and St. Petersburg. And what you have to remember is that these are highly populated areas. And of course, the rain then goes into the rivers. And then that's why we could still see some more flooding. You see, it's not just the rain that falls, but it's as the tide rises. So it's high tide at about 7 o'clock this morning, local time. So that's why there could still be more flooding. And of course, that storm surge around on the East Coast as well. It was a 1 in 1,000 year event for St. Petersburg because that sort of rainfall, very rare within that town. So that's record rainfall there, certainly.
It was a category 4 before it made landfall and then quickly slowed to a category 1. I mean, this again is all relative, but just explain to us briefly, why does that happen? Why does it lose power as it passes over land?
Because it doesn't have the energy that the sea surface temperatures provide. So the hurricane basically intensified very, very quickly, Milton, in the Gulf of Mexico, because it's so hot in the Gulf of Mexico.
I mean,
the sea surface temperatures,
is that right?
Very unusual. It went within 24 hours, it went from being a Category 1 storm to being a Category 5. I mean, it developed. It was named on Saturday. I was in working on Sunday. And then by the time I came back Monday, By the evening, it was already a Category 5 hurricane. This is enormous. It's so, so quick for a hurricane to intensify. The sea surface temperatures are 29 to 31 degrees Celsius in the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, it's all made much more likely by man-made climate change, of course, that the sea surface temperatures are so high. So that's what fuels the hurricane. So Milton made landfall as a Category 3. So it was a Category 5. It then slowed down. The eye wall was lost and then it reformed again. It made landfall as a Category 3 and it tracked through Florida. It's still a hurricane at the moment. So when it hits land, it loses with the friction, basically, it loses the energy and it slows down. So the wind speeds will slow, but the damage in a lot of cases has already been done. And most of the damage from hurricanes is not actually from the wind speeds. It's from the rainfall associated with it. So the rain that falls out of the sky and also the storm surge as well.
Just one final question. I mean, people looking at the BBC weather app this morning may have been slightly shocked to see that there were hurricanes everywhere in the world. What went wrong with the app?
Yeah, this is very embarrassing for BBC Weather, and we are really sorry. We're taking it very seriously indeed. So it's a glitch with our data provider, and they're working very hard to fix it. But of course, there are not hurricanes in every part of the world. There was a hurricane in Florida, and not across the UK, not in other parts of the world.
It wasn't malicious intent by somebody.
It doesn't. I am not the boss, but. What we have been told is that it's a data glitch with our provider, and we're working very hard to fix it. And we're very sorry, of course.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed for coming by. The BBC's lead weather presenter, Elizabeth Rossini there. Now, with less than 4 weeks to go before the US presidential election, it's perhaps not surprising that the response to Hurricane Milton and Helene before it have been sucked into the toxic political atmosphere. It's because of statements like this from the Republican candidate and former president, Donald Trump.
Kamala spent all her FEMA money billions of dollars on housing for illegal migrants.
Well, on Wednesday, President Biden condemned what he called a, quote, reckless, irresponsible, relentless promotion of disinformation and outright lies, saying that Donald Trump had been the one leading what he called the onslaught.
Former President Trump has led this onslaught of lies. Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true. They're saying people impacted by these storms will receive $750 in cash and no more. That is simply not true either. They're saying that money needed for these crises are being diverted to migrants. What the heck are they talking about? Stop it. It's outrageous. It's just not true.
There have also been a growing number of conspiracy theories swirling on social media about the storm itself, including one pushing the false claim that the weather was being controlled by the US government. Let's talk to Daniel Lipman, Washington reporter for Political. Daniel, good to have you with us here on NewsHour. I mean, it does seem extraordinary that in the middle of a natural disaster, this sort of row is going on. I mean, is this something new?
Well, the internet has really supercharged all of these conspiracy theories, and everyone with a Twitter or Instagram account can spread this and say whatever they want. What's interesting is that, you know, this is happening three or four weeks before the election. And so both sides are kind of viewing this in a political perspective. We saw the Harris campaign do a TV ad against Donald Trump, accusing him of preventing aid for wildfire victims in California because it's a Democratic state. And so I think, you know, they're viewing this as something to take advantage of during this these two storms.
And what is former President Trump's thinking? I mean, does it score points with his supporters and giving him, you know, help him in this election race, do you think? I mean, or is he just talking off the cuff?
Well, he has never been a person who has been bounded by the truth. And so even Republicans know that he lies or misleads all the time. And so he wants to talk about the immigration crisis as a much better issue for him instead of the news of the day. And he wants to also make these two storms into a political albatross around Biden and Harris, given in 2005, Hurricane Katrina did that for George W. Bush. It hit New Orleans, and there was a famous image of Bush looking at the damage from his plane and not actually helping the thousands of people, millions of people who needed help back then.
I talked about this false claim that the weather's being controlled by the US government. I mean, people might scoff of that, but that isn't in the very dark recesses of the internet. I mean, this was a big supporter of Donald Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was also pushing it, wasn't she?
Yeah, so she was saying that the federal government was doing this to hurt Republicans and to hit Republican voters because Florida is a red state. And she was criticized by fellow Republican members of Congress who said, hey, if you're spreading this totally false claim, then maybe you should get your head checked. That last we checked, Marjorie Taylor Greene is not a meteorologist, and you know, the federal government can barely process people's tax returns on time, let alone control the weather.
Right. Just one final thought. I mean, is there any evidence that anything, any of these attacks or defenses at this stage are moving the dial in this election?
Not that much. For people who are going to think that the FEMA money, the emergency management money, was all used to house migrants, they were probably not going to vote for Kamala Harris in the first place. And so I think he uses this almost as red meat to get his own base out instead of persuading undecided voters.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed. As ever, Daniel Lipman, political reporter, Washington reporter, rather, for Politico. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Just to say that there are live updates, of course, on the aftermath and what is still going on as Hurricane Milton moves away from the Florida coast on our website, bbc.com/news. This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC. On yesterday's programme, we were talking about the All England Tennis Club's decision to get rid of line judges at Wimbledon. Well, another fixture of top-class tennis will also be taking his leave from later this year. The Spanish superstar Rafael Nadal today took to social media to announce his retirement.
Hello everyone, I am here to let you know that I am retiring from professional tennis. The reality is that it has been some difficult years, these last two especially. I don't think I've been able to play without limitations. It is obviously a difficult decision, one that has taken me some time to make, but in this life everything has a beginning and an end. And I think it's an appropriate time to put an end to a career that has been longer and much more successful than I could have ever imagined. He's done it!
Let's talk to Mark Petchy, former British number one, and also a coach to Andy Murray and Emma Raducanu. Mark, thanks very much for being with us today. It feels like the end of an era, is it?
Yeah, it is very much so. He is... Yeah, I think it's always difficult to say someone's irreplaceable, but I think Rafa's exploits at Roland Garros and, of course, at the other three majors, Olympic gold, has made him almost in that category. And he changed the game, and I don't say that lightly. I think there's very few players that came along, people like Bjorn Borg, Rod Laver, to name a few. There's obviously been great champions of the past, but Rafa's way of playing, his look when he first came onto tour, the Davis Cup final against America in 2004, beating Roddick on the clay. There were so many sort of signposts to his greatness, and the changing of the game will arguably be his biggest legacy.
And when you talk about that, I mean, is that his, what, devastating forehand?
Yeah, his forehand, his way of obviously defending at the back of the court, the shot-making skills that he had, and just his invincibility on clay. I think it's arguably, I think if you talk to most tennis players, the most strategic of surfaces in many ways, people feel because of that it's a great leveler. And yet you had a guy that was virtually unplayable on the surface. And I think that those statistics for me are probably some of the greatest that we'll ever see, not just in tennis, but across the board in sport.
And did he raise the game of other great players like Federer and Djokovic, do you think?
There's no question. I mean, he made Roger a better player, certainly towards the back end of Roger's career. His back end got better because of the way that Rafa had played him in the past. And obviously, you know, Novak as well became a better player because of the way that he had to play against Rafa. And he ultimately became the first player that Rafa had to change his style against to play Novak. So each of those three kind of raised each other's games. And then obviously we were the great beneficiaries of their tennis.
And astonishing longevity. I mean, his career just seemed to... I mean, I know he's had some problems with injury in the last couple of years, but I mean, it's an amazingly long career at the very top of the game, isn't it?
It has been for all of them. And I think that's, again, part of their legacy is that they've hung around so long that the next era of Alcaraz, Sinner coming through have actually also sort of benefited from that, because we can measure their level of tennis against the level that we know that we've seen over the last sort of 15 years that has been ultimately, you know, as special as we've ever had in tennis. But I do think there's one little story that I will tell very quickly. I know you guys have got to get to your next story, yeah. But the one thing about Rafa that will always remain in my mind, it was either 07 or 08 when he'd already won a couple of majors, was already the big star. He was walking through, because it was his birthday at Roland Garros every year, with a group of about 7 or 8 of his team and people from Roland Garros. I was sitting at a computer 25 yards away from where he was walking. He saw me. He came out of the group, walked across, shook my hand, said, "How are you doing?" Because he knew me through Andy. We'd been on the practice court a few times, asked how I was doing. And that stayed with me forever, because he never changed. He was as great a champion as he was an even better person.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Mark Petchy there, paying tribute to Rafael Nadal, who announced his retirement from professional tennis today. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency? climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.